From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. President Trump, we all know, sees immigration as one of his winning issues. He's more than willing to make extreme threats like closing the border entirely if it makes him look tough. One reason the issue works so well for him is that the Democrats tend to avoid it entirely. There really isn't a coherent view of immigration in the Democratic Party. And most candidates in the race now barely bring it up, except to object to what Trump does. But at least one Democratic candidate is eager to talk about immigration. Julian Castro served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Obama administration. But he also is former mayor of San Antonio in Texas, right near the border. And he wants to change the terms of the presidential debate entirely. Castro has suggested that entering the United States without papers should no longer be a federal crime. I spoke to Julian Castro last week, and I asked him why he thought focusing on immigration policy was precisely the way to beat Donald Trump.
There are different reasons that I've chosen to focus early on and rolled out as my first policy plan on immigration. Number one, that's close to my heart. My family story is an immigrant's American dream story. I grew up with a grandmother that had come over from Mexico when she was seven. She worked as a maid, a cook, and a babysitter, raised my mom as a single parent. My mom became the first one to graduate from high school, go on to college. My brother Joaquin and I were able to go to college, to law school, to become the first in our family to become professionals as lawyers.
And you're the son of real activists, of political activists.
Yeah, so my mother and father were involved, mostly my mom, but my dad for a little while, involved in the old Chicano movement, the Mexican-American civil rights movement of the late 1960s and early 70s. And my mother was a hellraiser when she was young. She had started off in the Young Democrats and then part of the Raza Unida party that was a third party that at the time said that neither the Democrats nor Republicans are really sufficiently serving the needs of the Mexican-American community in Texas and the Southwest, so they formed their own party. And by the time my brother and I were growing up, you know, her activism was sort of tamping down, but we still grew up being taken to rallies and speeches and different organizational meetings. And so we grew up around this sense that participating in the democratic process was a good thing.
Well, as you watch President Trump behave as he does on the question of immigration, as you listen to his rhetoric on the question of immigration, let me ask you this. Is Donald Trump a racist?
No, I think he behaves like a racist.
What's the difference?
I don't think there is a difference.
So then you're saying he is a racist?
Yeah, I believe that he has been racist, sure.
And how do you go about defeating that? Because I must tell you, it behaves as if he is absolutely convinced that this kind of rhetoric of division on immigration is a winner for him, maybe more than any other issue.
I wanted to go straight to what this president has considered his bread and butter issue. This is how he stokes division. This is how he stokes fear and paranoia. This is what he's counting on in terms of an issue to win a narrow electoral college victory. And so I've released a People First immigration plan that represents a completely different vision, you know, and we can get into it in a second.
Well, what's at the core of it?
Well, at the core of it is that we should treat people with compassion and not cruelty and stop treating people like criminals and instead treat border crossing like we used to, which is a civil violation, reduce the backlog of people who are waiting for some sort of adjudication in our immigration legal process. You know, somebody deserves a hearing. They get their hearing, whether they're claiming asylum or they're here undocumented, and we can make decisions so people are not waiting years and years in limbo in the United States, that we create a pathway to citizenship for people who are undocumented, who are here, the 10 to 11 million people, not only Dreamers, but also their parents and other undocumented individuals who have not committed a serious crime. Also that we take a long-term smart view. Why would a mom come here with her six-year-old infant from Honduras or El Salvador or Guatemala? In most cases, it's because there's a tremendous danger over there. They can't find safety and they can't find opportunity. So I've proposed the equivalent of a 21st century Marshall Plan for Central America so that we can help build up safety and opportunity there and then get the benefit of not having, like we did last month, 92,000 people show up at our southern border.
Now, one of your proposals is to repeal the law which makes illegal entry in the United States a federal crime. Why do you see starting there as an essential first step?
Because the mess that's been created, the chaos that's been created with family separation, this cruelty, a lot of the backlog that we have, a lot of the expense in the system has developed after 2004. Before 2004, we used to, even though this law was on the books, we used to basically treat this as a civil violation, a civil penalty. After 2004, we started using incarceration more and treating it as a crime. That's what's led to this mess with family detention, with separation, with the backlog that we have. So I believe that we can have a better system if we go back to treating it as a civil violation with enhanced monitoring of these families so that they show up for their court date.
Now, any number of political leaders, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a congresswoman from the Bronx and Queens, wants to ban ICE, wants to ban Immigration and Customs Enforcement as an institution, feels it's been so morally compromised that it's impossible to go on. I don't hear that from you. What do you want to do?
I want to break it up and separate the enforcement part of it, put that back into mostly the Department of Justice, and then have Homeland Security Investigations, which is a separate unit of ICE, you know, go on and do its investigations. About a year and a half ago, there were 19 people who work for ICE employees that said, look, this is not working. The setup of this department is not working. And I believe that enforcement would be better served if we actually break ICE apart and separate Homeland Security Investigations from the other part of ICE.
So the institution is not fundamentally broken in such a way, there aren't so many violations and documented cases of mistreatment by ICE that you think it's necessary to dissolve it?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to do away with, or we should do away with, enforcement completely, but I do think that we should reconstitute it, and that's part of my plan. I don't think that it should go on the way that it's been. I think that it needs to be changed from the way that agents are trained to, you know, administratively where it's located in the federal government.
Now, if you get as far as a debate stage with President Trump, I guarantee you that he's going to say you're for open borders. Are you?
I'm not, and nobody is talking about open borders. We have 654 miles of fencing. We have thousands of personnel. We have guns. We have boats. We have planes. We have helicopters. We have security cameras all over the border. I'm talking about a system where people still are subject to deportation. So nobody's talking about open borders. But the thing is, David, as you know, it doesn't matter if I have a plan or another Democrat has a plan, he's going to say we're all for open borders, just like they're going to call us socialist. It doesn't matter if you proposed that we literally move to a socialist system or that some people get relief on student loans. They're going to say that it's socialism. Part of the reason that I've proposed this immigration plan and that it's so bold is because number one, I don't buy into the BS narrative that the people who are coming to the southern border represent a national security threat. Secondly, because—
What does it represent?
Desperation and the beauty of this country, that people still see this country as a place of opportunity and safety. And that is beautiful in its own way. You know, my brother has this wonderful line that I wish I'd thought of, my brother Joaquin, who's in Congress, that says— that there's something a lot worse than the day when so many people want to come to this country, which is the day that nobody wants to come to this country. And people around the world want to come to the United States. We need an orderly way to sort that out. What we don't need is the kind of cruelty that this administration has engaged in. But the other reason that I put forward this bold immigration plan is that I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of the president on this issue. I was in McAllen, Texas, on the border on Father's Day of last year with a group of activists to protest this family separation policy. And as depressing and dismaying as it was to be at this Ursula Processing Center where they were separating children from their families, it was uplifting to see that the activists that were there were white and black and of all different backgrounds, not only Latino. And it reminded me that we share common values and beliefs. And one of those is to treat people with basic respect. I'm betting fundamentally that in that head-to-head that we can win with that.
Where are you on the impeachment question? Your brother sits in the House of Representatives. You're close, however competitive, but you're close. There's a big question now. Nancy Pelosi says, let's just continue investigating. Impeachment might be counterproductive. And then there are people within the Democratic caucus who say, you know, what more evidence of obstruction of justice do we need than what we find in the Mueller report? Where are you on this?
I believe that the predicate is there for impeachment, that the question is going to become, this guy on these different occasions basically tried to obstruct justice. The fact that he was Fredo and not Michael.
Right? You're referring to the Corleones.
That's right.
Fredo meaning the dumb brother and not Michael.
The fact that he was
sage.
Fredo and nobody respected him enough to carry out his orders versus somebody whose orders may have been carried out like Richard Nixon. That does not absolve him of the fact that he tried to break the law, tried to obstruct justice. And so they're going to have to make a decision about whether we're going to uphold that rule of law and hold him accountable.
What are you hoping?
I hope they do.
You hope they impeach. You're
for impeachment. I hope they hold him accountable, yeah.
Now, I hate to skip from the high-mindedness of policy and the rest to the grittiness of politics, but I have to ask, it's obvious that you're not leading the pack at the moment, but we're many months away from these early primaries and caucuses. What is your path to victory? Any candidate has to have in his or her mind a way of seeing the field winnowing and you emerging, as realistic as you are. What is that path?
My path is, of course, I'm going to focus a lot on these early states, especially that first state of Iowa. I believe that I can do well in Iowa and then go and do well in especially a state like Nevada, which is the third state. And then right after—
New Hampshire doesn't look good.
Well, it can. We're going to spend a lot of time there too. But I've gotten the strongest reaction in Nevada. And
I'm just curious, for a politician, what does that mean, the strongest reaction? You're doing a lot of retail politics. You're going into diners and all kinds of small halls and people's homes. What does that mean, a strong reaction, as opposed to, uh-oh, I'm in trouble?
You can just tell by the reaction of the crowd. And, you know, anybody, and I would imagine it's not just in politics, right?
But what does bad feel like? Describe for me what bad feels like.
Man, there is a range of bad, right? bad from people walking out of the room while you're talking to not really paying attention.
Oh, does that happen? You're talking and people are hitting the door?
Not very often, but sometimes.
That's got to sting.
You know, sometimes you can tell that you've hit on an issue that somebody really disagrees with.
Tell me for an instance of that.
I've noticed sometimes that, yeah, I'm very blunt about this issue of police brutality.
And that's sensitive.
And I have, yeah, I think I've noticed on two or three occasions that you know, one or two people right after that will sometimes, I don't know if it's directly related to that, mm-hmm. but, you know, have basically, you know, had enough of what
they
I'm
check
saying.
Out.
So be it. I mean, I continue to do it because I believe what I'm talking about and the path that we need to take as a nation. But, you know, the overwhelming majority of folks that are there because they're interested in hearing from me or from whichever candidate that they're there to listen to. But on balance, in Iowa and Nevada so far, I can tell that the reaction is the strongest.
Now, if this narrative doesn't end with a victory, sometimes younger politicians run to run again. And or they run for something else. You decided not to run for statewide office. Is that a possibility in the future?
I'm not even going to think about that right now. Let me give you the typical politician's response, David.
And I'll do my typical yeah, roll of the eyes as the typical
reporter.
We can
play the part right here.
Fair enough.
Y'all can't see this, but we'll play the part. Yeah, I mean, you know, I believe that I can win. You know, I'm not the front runner now, but I wasn't born a front runner. I didn't grow up a front runner. I'm going out there and doing what families across the country do and what my family did, which is to work hard, to scrap, to do everything that I can do to be successful. And I believe that I can be. And, you know, the voters are going to decide starting next year.
Julian Castro, it's great to have you here again. Good luck to you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Julian Castro. He's running for the Democratic nomination, and I'll be talking with more of the candidates. Certainly there's enough to go around in the weeks to come, all on the New Yorker Radio Hour. And I'll be back with staff writer Larissa McFarker in a moment. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you've had any experience caring for a family member or a loved one who's losing their memory, you don't need me to tell you just how painful it can be for everybody involved. That experience is going to become more and more familiar as the number of people living with Alzheimer's disease in this country continues to rise. But the thinking about how to care for such patients is also starting to evolve. Staff writer Larissa McFarker recently spent some time at a new kind of assisted living facility for memory care patients, one of only a few like it in the United States. The place is called The Lantern, located in the Cleveland suburb of Chagrin Falls, Ohio. It houses around 40 residents who have some form of dementia or Alzheimer's.
Okay, let's go for a walk.
Let's go. Let's take a little walk.
Should we hold hands?
Yeah.
Okay.
Erna and I were walking down a wide hallway, and it had been designed to look like a street in a small American town of maybe 75 years ago. The floor was covered in carpeting, kind of green, mottled with a darker green that made it look a little bit like grass. And there was daylight coming in from skylights, and then between the skylights there were light panels that were painted to look like sky. The illusion was surprisingly effective. It didn't fool you exactly. You didn't feel as though you were actually outdoors, but it alleviated the claustrophobia that you usually feel in a hospital corridor. It felt like somewhere nice to walk.
Would you like to meet my mom? My mom is a nice person.
I would love to.
She's very easy with everybody.
There were other residents walking too, some of them with aides and some of them just by themselves going for a stroll. In the middle of the unit, there was an open space that was, again, designed to look like a kind of small park or a town square. There was a fountain, a few benches, and there were a few people gathered around some tables, sitting on chairs, playing a game with some aides.
What does that say, Carmen?
It says horses.
Now you have to look on the table and find a horse.
Yeah, I can't bring a horse. It's in my house. I can't bring a horse in my house.
Carmen, look. Too big. What's this?
It looks like one.
Yep.
I don't want a horse. Couldn't have a horse in my house.
Larissa, I used to go visit my grandmother at what I guess you call a unit, and there were people screaming. There were TVs blasting, which may or may not have been upsetting to the patients. It was hard to gather. People were so far gone in some ways. But it certainly was upsetting to me. How different is this, and how was it conceived? What's the idea here?
The idea is that people who live there should not feel like they live in a hospital. The idea is that they live in something that feels as much as possible like an ordinary town. And you know, people find themselves saying things like, oh, where's your house? It's at the other end of the street. So each room for the resident had a front porch, and people could decorate them however they wanted to. The staff are extremely open to accommodating personal touches on the part of the residents to make them feel at home. There's one house outside which there's a large dentist's office sign.
It's a big sign. It was his dental sign that was on his building.
Molly Gebler's dad used to be a dentist, and everyone at the Lantern still calls him Dr. Joe.
And I had called the Lantern and said, hey, there's this dental sign. Is there any way we can put it next to his house? And there wasn't even, they didn't look at the sign. They didn't see the sign. It was a yes, absolutely, because they support that. They want it to be their home. Mm-hmm. That's what their philosophy is all about, is just continuing to live their true life.
Well, it's not their true life. And in a sense, and I hate to use this word, but we're fooling them.
Well, yes. You know, Molly told me that he used to spend a lot of time asking her why He wasn't still practicing. Where was his office?
We really get into it a lot. Used to get into it a lot. We had sold the office, and he was mad about that. And
right.
Every day, that would be the conversation. He'd get angry about it.
What would you say?
You know what? At the beginning, I would say, "Well, you can't anymore.
Because
you know, you're not doing well. You're not fit to do it." Yes, I am, and I'm working. Mm-hmm. I get up every morning and I exercise. And look at my hands. You know, these hands are, you know, they're ready and they're not shaking. Or I'm fine. And
I mean, Mike's experience with my father and other relatives and even friends who have sunk into a state of dementia as it got worse was that they would fixate on an idea and they could not be swayed from it.
Yeah, Molly says in the early days of her father's sickness, they fought all the time. And so she went to one of the professionals at the Lantern and asked her advice.
So I went to her in tears, and I remember her saying, you can't argue with them. Like, you're not going to get to a resolve. Mm-hmm. You have to readjust and find out what it is that he's trying to say, finding out what the conversation is, and then redirecting it. Or saying, okay, so if you were, what do we need to do? What are the steps we need to do to get you back to dentistry? And then go through those steps with him, and then he'll probably go off to something else.
So this is what people call redirection. You know, you go along with it. You say, yeah, okay, we need to get your building back. What are we going to do? And then hope that the distraction will take over before anything really confrontational starts.
So the idea is to engage the project somehow, but not really do anything about it.
Exactly. And Andrea Parado helps train the aides here in how to do that.
So with my one client that struggles with her money issues every day, she worries about where her money is and has somebody sold her house and, you know, where's all her stuff and why can't she just go to the bank? And for her, she just needs a lot of reassurance and a lot of, you know what, let me look into that. Let me see what I can do. Let me see if I can find those resources for you. Let me see if I can get in touch with a lawyer for you. You know, I may not do that because obviously she has a guardian and the lawyers have already deemed her unable to care for herself.
Is that the status quo now in the care of dementia?
Well, it's often not official, but it in fact seems to happen pretty much everywhere. There was a survey not long ago that found that almost 100% of care staff in dementia wards say that they lie to patients, and something like 70% of doctors say they do too. But it's still a very fierce debate because people don't like the idea of lying to patients. They don't call it lying. They call it therapeutic lying. They call it going with the flow. There's lots of euphemisms.
What's the alternative then? Constantly correcting people?
Well, you know, that did used to be the norm in dementia care, and some places took it even further. There was a protocol called reality orientation, where the idea was that if you constantly drilled people with dementia in facts about everyday life, they might regain a grasp on reality. So things like, you know, the day of the week, the month of the year, who the president is, what the weather is, that kind of stuff. And that kind of drilling doesn't happen much anymore, but a lot of care homes still have strict no-lying policies. And Andrea said she worked in a place like that when she first started in this in dementia care, and she really tried to stick to the honesty rule.
I tried it, Larissa. I can't even lie, and I felt so guilty because I told this 90-year-old woman that I'm sorry, you know, you're 90 and your mom has passed away, and she just started crying. She just started crying, and she had to grieve all over. And from that moment on, after I sat there and cried and held her and comforted her, I stopped right then and there and said, "I'm never doing that again. Nope, I cannot put somebody through that ever again."
Yeah.
From now on, your mom went shopping. your mom had to go to the store. I don't know, but it's never going to be your mom has died. Never. I can't do that. I know that some people find that it's wrong to lie to somebody. I mean, it's a 90-year-old human being and she has the right to have the truth told to her. I get that. But when you're in the moment, you'll change your mind.
It seems like a horrifying way to make a living, to be a caregiver and have to cause people to grieve all over again.
Oh, it's miserable. I mean, and we're talking all day, every day. And, you know, it's even more complicated because of their memory loss, someone can be miserable and not even know why.
And one of the things that we are constantly talking about on these subjects is the notion of dignity. So how do dignity and lying come into conflict or coexist?
Yeah, so I asked Andrea about that.
Dignity is being respectful, I guess, of people's needs, of who they are. And with Alzheimer's disease, you have to respect them for where they are in the moment. I got in trouble at a nursing home once because I had a client ask me if I could get her some Walt Disney coloring books. I got in trouble because it was undignified for me to give her little kid coloring books. So my question then would be, if I am at a stage 5 of the disease, okay, and my cognitive functional ability is at the age of a 4 to 10 to 12-year-old, why would it be considered undignified to give me a coloring book that is absolutely significant within my cognitive functional age? Dignity is about respecting a person for the person that they are and who they are and what their needs are. And does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So it does make sense what she's saying. She's really redefining dignity.
Right. She's defining it in terms of meeting people where they are in a moment in time and their capabilities.
Exactly.
Does that seem right to you?
You know, honestly, in the process of working on this story, people talked about dignity all the time. And I started to kind of hate that word because it felt like it was drawing attention to what was not dignified about their situation. You know, maybe we should just be using a different word.
Like what?
Well, if you keep talking about dignity and that's preventing you from giving someone a coloring book, maybe something else should be the goal. Like, I don't know, happiness or autonomy or living your life as you want to insofar as that's possible. But even leaving the word dignity aside, you know, it can sound when you talk to people who work in these units that lying is the answer, that it solves these problems. But in fact, lying itself brings problems of its own. So, okay, remember Molly Gebler, for instance. She stopped fighting with her father about whether he could practice dentistry again, and things got easier. But things are unpredictable with memory, and somebody may remember nothing in the morning, and then in the afternoon, suddenly they're sharp again, and this brings up its own problems.
So one time he called me. He was upset about something, and I said, well, okay, I will come by. And I didn't, because usually it's because he wasn't in his right seat for breakfast, or, you know, I mean, and I can't be running here every second.
Right.
So the next day he called again and he said, you know, are you going to come over? And I said, yes, I will. He said, oh, like what you told me yesterday?
Oh, God.
Well, it's one thing to learn to lie to someone you care about, but to get caught doing it.
Well, this is exactly the problem, because when you're taking care of someone with dementia, it can seem like the only thing that matters is their happiness and getting through the next moment if you're right in the middle of it. But, you know, I talked to this philosopher, Cicela Bock, who wrote a book about lying, and she drew my attention to exactly what you pointed to, which is the person with dementia is not the only person that matters. There's also you, the one who's doing the lying. What effect does that have on you? You get into the habit of lying every day, every day, every day to the person with dementia, and you tell yourself, well, that's for them. That's to make them happy. But as we all know, you can make all kinds of people happy by lying. So where do you draw the line? Sooner or later, you might find yourself lying a lot.
You think this is going to bleed into the rest of your life and your dealings with people who don't have dementia somehow?
Once you tell yourself lying is okay if it makes someone happy, you're opening a very wide door. And furthermore, there's the effect on other people who are around you. So suppose you're at a doctor's office with your parent with dementia. Everyone in the doctor's office, including, let's say, your small child sitting next to you, sees you lying your head off to your parent, obviously. Well, that contributes to a general sense that lying is okay, lying is kind, and that can have the potential to do something very, very dangerous, which is undermine our general sense that people usually tell the truth. A kind of social trust that is really precious and really fragile. And, you know, another time I saw this play out in the Lantern, we were sitting around a table with a few residents, and one woman named Mary was not paying attention because she was worrying about her husband.
Well, my husband is in the
she
hospital.
She wants to stay with you.
Since this morning. Uh-huh. And I want to see him. And nobody to take me.
Mary's husband died years ago, but she didn't remember.
What if we go pray for him? What if we go pray for him? Would that help?
But I got to see him.
Well, we can do that after we say a little prayer, okay?
Just take me home, okay?
And when no one would take her to see him in the hospital, she started asking to go home.
Your house is right here.
I only live about two blocks from here.
Tell her, what does the house look like?
Huh?
What does the house look like?
Well, it looks like a cute house. Yeah, it's a nice house.
Do you have a garden there?
I have a garden, yeah.
Do you grow vegetables or flowers?
Both. But I have to take care of it. But now there's nobody there. So please, somebody take me home. It's only two blocks away from here.
And she asked one person after another. She asked all the aides around the table. One person said she was out of gas. Somebody else said their car was in the shop.
Okay. We're going to have to wait a little bit, okay, until I get my car fixed. And I'll take you.
You'll take me then?
Yeah, once my car gets fixed by the fixer, we're going to go.
Okay.
Well, but you have to be calm.
Nobody can take me, huh?
No, everyone's car is messed up.
Huh?
Mary asked me too.
Can you do it for me?
I don't have a car here.
They got here on the bus.
Yeah?
The bus and the cab. They got here on the cab and a bus, so no one have a car. We all here, and we don't have a car.
Gee.
It went around and around and around. This went on for like 15 minutes, and she, I'm not sure she thought, had the thought, people here are lying to me, but she knew something was off.
She was disoriented by what they were telling her.
She knows it can't be true that everyone's car is broken, and she just felt like somehow people are gaslighting me.
Which you were.
Which we were. And did that make her feel better? No. Now she's surrounded by people who are not only strangers to her, but she doesn't think that they're telling her the truth. I mean, was it the better choice other than telling her husband was long dead?
So what do you do? You break the rule of lying to her in a useful way?
You know, there isn't one strategy that works all the time.
So 30, 40 years from now, and that's being extremely generous, could be a lot sooner, Larissa. You could be in this situation. I could be in this situation. Your daughters will be in middle age, my sons and my daughter. And after all this time spent with people with dementia, how do you want to be treated?
I don't know. I just do not know. Because the whole thing is that if I had dementia, I wouldn't be the person I am now. You know, if I tried to make a decision for my future self now, you know, I'd be all worried about my dignity and people lying to me and how humiliating that might be. But future me might just want to sit at a table and just get on with coloring something in a coloring book and be lied to. So I don't know.
That's Larissa McFarker, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and you can find a terrific piece that she wrote about this subject at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. There's a new show on Broadway right now, and it's called Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus. Now, extra credit if you got this already, but Titus Andronicus is one of Shakespeare's most obscure plays, and it's possibly his worst. It's certainly his bloodiest. Titus Andronicus makes an episode of Game of Thrones look like an episode of Cheers. So why would anyone want to write a sequel to such a play, and why would anyone want to go see it? Good questions, and I'm not the man to answer them. But I'm going to let Michael Shulman, who writes for The New Yorker, tackle it.
Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus, is a new work by a performer named Taylor Mack. Taylor is a playwright, a drag queen, a performance artist, and what I would call an avant-garde maximalist. If you think about downtown experimental theater, you might picture a single person in black on a stool on a bare stage. But Taylor puts on extravaganzas. He's best known for his show, A 24-Decade History of Popular Music, which takes 24 hours to perform. And it has costume after lavish costume and tells the story of 2.5 centuries of American history, but with Taylor's own kind of radical queer twist. Taylor has been a darling of the downtown theater scene for a long time, but what's different about Gary is that even though it has that same subversive, zany, eccentric sensibility, it's on Broadway. It's an absurdist comedy that picks up where Shakespeare's very gruesome tragedy leaves off. So the play starts, the curtain rises, and we see a Roman banquet hall with just a huge pile of dead bodies, just as many as you guys could fit on the stage.
Yeah.
And then Nathan...
Way more than died in the play, Titus Andronicus.
Right. Yeah. And then Nathan Lane walks out in clown makeup and...
His character's name is Gary, surprise, surprise, and he was the clown in Titus Andronicus, and Shakespeare uses a clown, meaning an everyman, and in my play, Gary calls himself an everyman who's a nobody else, and I just decided that his job was actually to be a clown, and he has about 13 lines in Titus Andronicus. He comes in for a little comic relief, and then they send him off to be hanged. And in my play, he escapes that hanging by getting himself a cleaning job to clean up the coup that has just happened. And the concept is that the coup, of course, didn't just happen in this contained little banquet room. When a coup happens, there's much more slaughter than just one room. And so the streets, of course, have all these casualties, and they're trying to bring in all the dead bodies from the streets and clean them up and get the empire ready for the inauguration they're holding in the morning.
Yeah, and there's a very elaborate protocol that he has to go through with his cleaning coworker.
Yeah.
They have to process these bodies in a really gross
right.
way.
Yeah. Well, of course, you have to clean them, and it's disgusting, and they got to do the dirty work, you know. So how do you clean a dead body? I did the research on how you would clean a dead body.
Did you?
Yeah. At that time and now and just kind of worked it in.
What did you find out?
Well, you have to get all the juices out of them, basically. You know, and you know, there's this element of I wanted to make it as disgusting as it could be and still still have people listen to the play.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's tons of scatological humor and...
Yeah, you know, you say tons, but let me just say this. It's been a real interesting thing to see that one scatological joke can dominate 20 minutes of a play, even if the other 20 minutes is all in verse and poetry. And you know, it's
well, there's also a corpse who pees into Nathan Lane's eye, so...
Yes,
stuff
well,
like that tends to stick with you.
That's a choice the actor made.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I like it. I think it's funny.
You ever think you don't want to do the job you've been assigned?
No point in that.
Just seems if this is the kind of thing you got to do on the regular, you might not be living your best life.
Oh, well, you think I got a choice? Oh, the options just open up to any who want them.
It just seems some folk get to do the fun jobs. And other folk got to do the not fun jobs.
Way of the world, so best get to it.
And so as much as the play grew out of Titus Andronicus, it also grew out of this crazy sequence of events that happened to you a couple years ago. Can you just describe what that was?
Yeah. I made a 24-hour concert called The 24-Decade History of Popular Music, and it was one of the more wonderful experiences of my life. And then right after that, I had to fly to California and do hospice work for my mom, who was dying. And then the election happened, and then 2 days later, she died. And I hadn't really had to deal with a dead body since the early 90s with the AIDS epidemic. So it'd been a while, so it kind of brought back some of that stuff. And then I went to Mexico for a couple of weeks just to decompress, and I was jogging on the beach, and a corpse washed up onto the shore. It was a tourist who had drowned,
And so it was the second, you know, dead body in so many weeks that I'd seen. And I just decided that I needed to put all of those feelings. I didn't know why I was feeling what I was feeling, when I was feeling it. So I just squished them all into a play. And
can I just back up to the corpse that washed out from the beach? Because, yeah. I mean, when you saw that, what actually went through your mind? You're just on the beach in Mexico. I'm sure it's beautiful. And you see a dead body. I mean, yeah. What was your reaction in the moment?
Well, I mean, it was not pretty. You know, a body that's drowned and been in the ocean for a while is not a pretty sight. So that was sad. I was also concerned about it because the tide was kind of coming out, and I thought the body was going to get sucked out again. So I thought, do I need to do something? But luckily, there were other people that kind of came up shortly after and called the authorities to take care of it and stuff. But I guess I just was sad. I just felt so sad for that person, and just sad for the state of the world, really. I just really, really just sat down on the beach and just felt sad.
It almost seems like you and these other people were the cleanup crew. You know, if there's a dead body, someone has to do something with it. So Gary has a line toward the end of the play. He says, cleaning is immoral. And that really stood out to me. I was wondering, do you feel like we do that too much as a society? Do we clean too much? Do we, you know, the ugliness or cover up what, you know, the grossness?
Yeah, I mean, cleaning is immoral. It sounds like a clickbait title. You know, it's not really a... He goes on to explain. It's not just that. It's that we're not cleaning and... we're not really cleaning. We're just kind of brushing everything under the surface and acting like it's clean. So we're not really doing the hard work to end systemic racism and classism and all of the isms. And, you know, I mean, we're really, we're just trying to do the bare minimum so that we can get by and make it look nice for the people who are basically in charge so that they can continue to be in charge. So there's not really a point to the play. It's more exploring considerations about how to clean and who's responsible for the cleaning and how can we be better cleaners and how to cope in a world of chaos is one of the big themes of the play.
Yeah. So just traveling back to your past a little bit, your early career doing monster drag, did you learn... stuff from working in drag about interacting with the audience or anything that you carried over into playwriting?
Sure. So much so. It's trickier. Well, what I learned from the audience is that if something is threatening to take the story away from the storyteller, you have to incorporate that threatening thing into the story at all costs. Otherwise, you know, they take over the story. So, you know, I'd be performing in the clubs and I'd be singing on my ukulele and it'd be a gay club, so people would be having sex, you know. And so everyone's watching the couple have sex and I'm trying to, you know, have them watch me and listen to my story. So then I have to kind of go over to the couple that are having sex and sing with them on my ukulele. And so now they're my collaborator instead of my opposition.
Right.
Or my heckler. You know, that's how I deal with hecklers all the time, is to just like make them my collaborator as best I can. My drag mother used to say to me, she got shot in the butt by some people that saw her walking down the street in drag. And, you know, when I said those horrible people, she said, no, not horrible. They just wanted to be part of the show.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah. You grew up in Stockton, California. Mm-hmm. Can you just describe Stockton as you experienced it, what your relationship with the town was?
At the time, it was that I wanted to get out and escape and not be there anymore because I was getting beat up. I was harassed on a regular basis. I had a very unhappy home life. And yet, I had these wonderful friends that I met there and who are still, they're my family at this point. And I just love them dearly. And so, I can't complain about my life because it's pretty damn good. So,
right.
So I have to kind of honor Stockton in a way for helping to make whatever it is that I am and this life is and this art that I'm making become.
What were your early attempts at expressing who you were in Stockton?
I mean,
did you find artistic outlets?
When you're queer, just like walking down the street is an expression. You know, I had a feminine walk, so I was teased for my feminine walk.
And then you had this profound experience as a teenager going to San Francisco and seeing. Was it the AIDS walk? Can you just describe what happened?
I guess I was 14. I hadn't met an out homosexual before. I'd met homosexuals, but they weren't out to me. And I used my paper route money because no one would give me money for the AIDS walk. And so we went to San Francisco. My friend Marcy was 2 years older, so we could drive, and she had a car. And we went to the AIDS walk. And the first time I saw an out homosexual, it was thousands all at the same time. So that's had a profound effect on my life and my work, in terms of that, to experience queer agency and queer pride and queer community en masse like that for the first time, because everyone was dying, or because loved ones were dying. And so that juxtaposition, but also because they were building themselves, because they were being torn apart. And so I think that's the kind of work that I've gravitated to making, is something that recognizes our frailty and the oppression that is inflicted on so many different kinds of people, and to see if we can make something out of that that's stronger than the oppression and stronger than the frailty.
You gave an interview to the New York Times recently where you said subtlety is a privilege. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. It's not that I don't use subtlety in my work. I love subtlety. Gary has lots of subtlety in it. 24 Decade has whole sections that are subtle. It's that it is a privilege that if you want to be subtle, then Larry Kramer is not subtle, right? All those AIDS activists had to fight for our right to be alive. And there was a clock was ticking. It wasn't just like some concept that, oh, people are oppressing us and maybe in 100 years they'll kill us. It was actually happening right then and there. So they didn't have time to write a play where people sit in a restaurant and talk about the waiter and maybe kind of pause a little bit and just kind of wonder and have something kind of underneath the surface that's bubbling up, and then, oh, it gets unleashed at the 11 o'clock scene, or it never does, and that's part of, I mean, I find that work very interesting. I like a lot of that work. I love it, in fact, but I see it as, oh, you're exercising your privilege. Great. Right. So that's all I'm saying. And great. A theater is so wonderful and large and has so many different aspects to it that we can exercise our privilege as well. And what a boring world if we didn't exercise some privilege. But it's also just nice to be aware that sometimes subtlety is confused with authenticity. And the only reason we think subtlety is authentic over an extravaganza is because of the Puritan dominance over expression. So that's how I feel about it.
Taylor, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for asking the fun questions.
Taylor Mack, speaking with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. Mack's new play, Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus, is on Broadway. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.